1 week before the anniversary of the martyrdom of Haj Qasim Soleimani. Isn't it a bit disappointing for the mujahideen of the axis of resistance to see their leaders being assassinated by their number one enemy?
First, allow me to say a few words about the Mara Brigadier General Sayyid Radi Al Musawi. He was one of the dear leaders and big brothers who lived with us in this region for more than 30 years, practically spending half his life or even more in our area. He played a crucial role in securing support for the resistance in Lebanon, Palestine, and the region as a whole. He was a comrade in arms with Haj Qasim Soleimani, following in his footsteps. He aspired to martyrdom, and I witnessed him after the martyrdom of Haj Qasim with teary eyes saying, "When will my turn for martyrdom come? I seek martyrdom just as Haj Qasim always did." I want to emphasize that this does not constitute disappointment. Why? Because our leaders aspire to be martyred. For some people, this may not be understood, but our leaders, whether in their armed resistance, support for resistance, or backing of fighters in the region, whether Iranian or non-Iranian, they look beyond material goals at the level of land, liberation, or victory. Their primary goal is to please Allah. If martyrdom is the highest accolade, with Allah, they love and desire it without hesitation or reluctance in fulfilling their duties.
إذا كانت الشهادة هي عنوان أعلى لرضا الله عز وجل فهم يحبونها ويرغبون بها دون أن يتكاسلوا أو أن يتوانوا عن قيامهم بواجبهم.
These leaders, chosen by Allah in the best moments of their giving, in the best moments of their lives, and in the best moments of their resistance work. This does not represent any weakness or disappointment for us. Yes, we feel the loss, undoubtedly. We feel that we have lost prominent leaders like Haj Qasim, Haj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and the dear Brigadier General Sayyid Razi al-Musawi. We feel their loss and acknowledge our need for them. However, at the same time, we fully understand that this path is one of sacrifices and the offering of blood and martyrs. This has been the history of resistance from its beginning until today. From the martyrdom of Sayyid Abbas to the martyrdom of Sheikh Raghib, Haj Imad Mughniye, and all our leaders and loved ones who have sacrificed themselves on this path. Therefore, it does not signify weakness or disappointment. In this battle, we fight on all fronts. Those on the front lines fight, those in resistance support fight, those in cultural work fight. And all of them are engaged in this resistance work, and every drop of blood shed on this path is a blessed point, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses it.
Well, talking about the current confrontation that we are living in West Asia since October 7, the Al-Aqsa flood operation, we saw the heroic zero-distance Palestinian operations happening in Gaza. We saw missiles continuing to be fired from Gaza despite the destruction and devastation inside of Gaza. Many, during this time, have repeated the name of Haj Qasim Soleimani, saying that linking his name to noticeable elevated capabilities of the Palestinian resistance. Is there a truth to those speculations? I mean, did Martyr Soleimani have a direct role in the visible developed capability inside of Palestine?
He devoted his entire life for Palestine, exerting every effort for its cause. Haj Qasim Soleimani is essentially a martyr of Al-Quds. Naturally, he gave the Palestinian cause the utmost he could give. If he regretted anything, it was that he couldn't give more than he did, mentally and physically. In our experiences with him, he always aimed to make the Palestinian resistance the best it could be in terms of capabilities, training, and expertise. He gave it his all. It's very natural that his presence in Gaza was strong to this extent because he spared nothing. He left nothing undone that he could offer to Palestine. Of course, without forgetting that the primary role belongs to the Palestinians themselves. They are the ones who received, requested, responded, benefited, and built their capabilities in planning, execution, and operations. They are the ones responsible for the heroic acts we witness today in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Well, Martyr Soleimani stood like an unknown soldier in Iraq, in Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, elsewhere, in other countries as well. But we really didn't really know his personality, his full capabilities and his personality until he sadly was martyred. I mean, he fought against Daesh, he fought against the Zionist entity right here in Lebanon in 2006. What was one significant memory that you had in mind that tells you that early on, this man had a vision and this vision would work, and we see it work 30 years later?
أولاً إلى الآن لم يكتشف العالم بالضبط من هو الحاج قاسم سليمان.
First of all, until now, the world hasn't fully discovered who Haj Qasim Soleimani is. This is left to the days and years to come, because what he built was very powerful and deeply rooted. These sincere efforts, which he dedicated his life to, laid the foundation for paths that the region will continue to witness results from. In the Iranian terminology or expression, when he was martyred, they used to say Qasim Nur Zendeh, meaning that Qasim continues to live. This term became common in those days. He is still alive, and we believe that martyrs are alive. Now, what Haj Qasim established is producing these splendid and good results, and the coming years will precisely reveal who Haj Qasim Soleimani is. When he first came to us in Lebanon in 1998, in the initial meeting, as we sat with him, he spoke little and asked many questions. We were observing, getting to know his person anew. Having heard about his heroic history and significant achievements during the war in Iran, he kept asking and asking until after a barrage of questions, he started talking about something new, a clear vision. He began comparing and saying, the operations you have against the Israelis somewhat resemble some of the patterns of operations we have in Iran. Not exactly as they were in Iran, but to some extent. As I recall, he mentioned that these types of operations we conducted in Iran, we did something similar. And if we want, we could do much more than that.
وكان يقول على ما أذكر هذا النوع من العمليات نحن نفذناه في إيران عملنا مثله إن شاء الله بإمكاننا أن نفعل أكثر من ذلك.
In the first meeting, he gave a lot of very high hopes. I don't hide that at that time, perhaps we all thought of this meeting as a form of courtesy, an Iranian expression of acquaintance. Maybe he was flattering us, wanting to boost our morale. However, within 3 months, everything changed for us. In just 3 months, the change became tangible and was felt. And we transition from one state to another. This speed in accomplishment and precision in the objective made us realize that we were dealing with a first-class operational and strategic person, typically a rare find, strong in operations to a great extent, strong in strategy and vision to a great extent, and astonishing in following up. If he said a weapon must come, he would follow it even if he had to go to the weapon factories in Iran, visit the factory, go to the Ministry of Defense, meet with the person responsible for providing the weapon, and keep tracking until he is reassured that this weapon has become secure for the resistance. A person with this level, vision, and huge capacity, of course, his entire presence is a blessing for the resistance, pushing the resistance strongly forward. This applies in Lebanon, and we can speak in the same way for the entire region.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with political analysts. Midstream is with you on IRIB English Radio.
The Islamic Resistance Hezbollah in Lebanon, it is considered the first ever native resistance in the world to be able to stand in the face of one of the most powerful armies in the world. It was Israel was considered the fourth most powerful army in the world, and Hezbollah was able to stand in front of it despite the fact that in the 80s and 90s, Hezbollah's Grad and Katyusha missiles were considered not that sophisticated in facing the Zionist Israeli entity, but later on it changed. How did the presence of Hash Qasim develop these capabilities, and with his martyrdom, were the capabilities affected?
من الآخر استشهاده أثر إيجابا رغم أننا خسرناه.
In short, his martyrdom had a positive impact, despite our loss, and we still yearn for him to be among us. But what he instilled in us and in our resistance is strong and enduring. One of Haj Qasim's distinguishing features is that he discovered the capabilities within Hezbollah, recognized them, and identified them. The youth of Hezbollah, as part of Allah's blessings on the level of resistance work and dedication, have a bright and powerful history. A knowledgeable, courageous, and daring people with qualities we all know.
وجهاد لهم تاريخ ناصع وقوي هم أهل المعرفة أهل شجاعة أهل إقدام وإلى ما شاء الله من وصفات نعرفها جميعا. هو آمن بالمقاوم في حزب الله.
He believed in the resistance within Hezbollah, trusted it, and believed that these youth could do much more than they were doing. This was the starting point and the foundation. So he gave them all this support and opened all these doors. He believed that the potential within our hands did not match the spiritual, intellectual, human, and scientific capacities present in the youth of Hezbollah. Therefore, he motivated these potentials and opened doors for them.
حفز هذه الإمكانات وفتح لها الأبواب ولذا التقاؤهم على حاج عماد رحمة الله عليه لم يكن
Thus, his meeting with حاج عماد مغنية may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have mercy on him was not a coincidental meeting but a meeting of creativity and mutual trust. He trusted حاج عماد's intellect, believed in his courage and gave him everything he could give. He opened all the doors for him. Of course, the youth of Hezbollah had this readiness, and he discovered this readiness, bet on it, and that's how we reach where we are now. This was, of course, a very significant turning point in the resistance work within Hezbollah, a very bright point. We believe that this was a divine blessing that came from heaven through Haj Qasim. Not only for us as Lebanese, but also for Palestine, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and the entire region. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in his wisdom spared him for this role and he did not decree for him to be a martyr alongside his loved ones, with whom he wished to be martyred. However, Allah wanted him to remain alive until this stage to give us everything he has given us. Inshallah, we'll remain faithful to his blood, his sincerity, and his sacrifices.
وإن شاء الله نحن نكون أوفياء لدمه لإخلاصه لعطائه.
But you know, many were saying that Haj Qasim Soleimani stands with Syria because you mentioned his role in Syria. They said that, which was basically he was representing the Iranian government in Syria by being there, by helping the Syrian government. But many said that the stances that Iran took, that Haj Qasim took, that Hezbollah took in Syria was a short-sighted stance that could have rid Hezbollah and Iran from very much of a hostility base in the international community. I know that you don't believe that, and I know that Hezbollah has suffered as much as Iran also has suffered in that area, but how would you explain that to our Western audience?
بالحقيقة نحن قرار الدفاع عن سوريا وعن شعب سوريا أولا لأن وجدنا أن الشعب السوري معتدى عليه.
In truth, our decision to defend Syria and its people was primarily because we found that the Syrian people was under attack. Unfortunately, some in the West and some Arabs created what they called the Syrian Revolution, which did not exist. It was media exaggeration. If we had asked the Syrian people at that time, the majority were with the government. Yes, they had issues with the government. There were things they liked and things they didn't. We acknowledged that. But we also knew that the Syrian people were with the government, and the evidence is what we achieved in the results. After 10 years of fighting, I believe that if the West had fairness and if the world had fairness, they would have discovered and known that the majority of the Syrian people were not against the government. The one who worked to incite armed extremist groups, specifically the Takfiri ones, and later witnessed them in Daesh in Iraq was the West. The Americans allegedly came to fight them. But the one who actually fought them was Haj Qasim Soleimani, not the Americans. These Americans were the ones supporting Daesh in Syria. These Takfiris did not have a vision for Syria, neither a national Syria nor Syria the state. They dreamed of a broad caliphate that wanted to impose its control over the entire region. Let's not forget the hints and movements by some Western countries, as acknowledged by some Americans and politicians, including statements by Hillary Clinton that still exist and can be reviewed by everyone. What Hillary Clinton spoke about years later, we knew from the beginning. So we entered Syria to prevent it from falling into the hands of Takfiris, ensuring that Lebanon and Iraq will not be threatened and safeguarding the entire Arab and Islamic world from such a threat.
I want to end off where I started with Palestine. A lot of your local, regional, and international foes are saying that Hezbollah, by standing with the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, by supporting it militarily in South Lebanon, that Hezbollah is actually bringing nothing but despair to Lebanon, that Hezbollah chose to support his brothers and sisters in Gaza, but you have cost Lebanon a lot because of this confrontation. How would you reply to that?
أولا الذين يقولون حزب الله أتى بالولايات على لبنان هم نفسهم الذين كانوا يقولون في مواجهة العدو الإسرائيلي.
First, those who claim that Hezbollah brought calamities upon Lebanon are the same ones who, in the face of the Israeli enemy, used to say that Hezbollah led Lebanon to destruction. However, after Lebanon was liberated, they found the opposite result. So we have presented evidence before. Today, they are making the same mistake again. They are a minority in Lebanon anyway. Second, ambassadors, ministers, and embassies approached us and spoke with many Lebanese entities, both politicians and non-politicians, telling them that the front in southern Lebanon should calm down. Why? They answered because in the Israeli entity, there are mad rulers. Western foreign ministers told the Lebanese that these Israeli entity leaders are crazy. Therefore, if this front doesn't calm down, it might escalate because they are crazy. So we told them, the response is in what these Westerners said. If the rulers of the Israeli entity are crazy, should we rely on them or should we be strong in the face of them? Because when the mad person sees strength against him, he recoils. If we slack, his madness might turn against us. Third, we believe that what is happening in Gaza is not only related to Gaza, but is linked to the entirety of the region. Netanyahu declared that we would witness a different Middle East. He said everything would change. This means America, when it agreed and provided all its weapons and ammunition to the Israeli entity, is now participating in killing children without accepting a ceasefire. In fact, America says in the Security Council that now is not the time for a ceasefire, while the whole world watches the killing of children. What does that mean? It means that America carries with it a major project. The issue is not only related to Gaza. After Haj Qasem Soleimani, and in the era of resistance we are in today, the era of resistance has provided a new awareness. What worked in 1948 does not work now, and what worked in the 60s does not work now. What worked in the hands of traitorous rulers does not work now. Things have changed, and because they have changed, the Americans need to understand. If they realize it, they benefit, and if they don't, they will lose, and that's their affair. But ultimately, we know that what happens in Gaza has significant effects and repercussions on the regional level. I will speak with Lebanese logic. At least if Netanyahu's project succeeds in Gaza and the people of Gaza are expelled to Sinai, thus associating the people of the West Bank with Jordan, then giving Lebanese citizenship to the refugee Palestinians in Lebanon will become a prevailing reality. At that point, those who criticize our actions in the south, what will they say? If the Gaza war succeeds for Netanyahu, it will lead us to naturalization in Lebanon. Do we fight our Palestinian brothers so that they are not naturalized in Lebanon, causing internal strife? Or do we fight the Israeli entity before they reach the stage of imposing naturalization, both them and the Americans? I believe the answers are clear and self-evident. We are in the era of resistance, in the era of awareness, and in the era of intellect, knowledge, and science. All the lies of America and the West, I believe, are now exposed. And no one can trust America and its claims in this world anymore. We care about our people. Whether we are oppressed or under attack, we think about how to defend ourselves. The people of Gaza defend themselves, and we preserve our country and our borders, offering what is required of us. It is not our duty or mandate to explain everything to others. If they don't realize this now, they will realize it over time. This is our history with them.
ليس من وظيفتنا أو من تكليفنا أن نوضح للآخرين كل شيء. إن لم يدركوا هذا الأمر سيكون مع الأيام. هكذا هو تاريخنا مع هؤلاء.
Well, Your Eminence, Sayyid Hashim Safieddine, head of the Islamic Resistance Hezbollah's Executive Council in Lebanon, thank you very much for your time and your contribution to our show. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on with us. Ladies and gents, it was a pleasure to have you on board MidEastStream in this very special episode in commemoration of Hajj Qasim Soleimani's martyrdom. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we are going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. And today we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been having some questions that we wanted you to answer, and you've been answering the questions very nicely, and inshallah we'll be asking you some more today. We were discussing about the question where somebody was asking, you know, how to control their students in a class setting. At times it gets difficult, and you gave very good points. So do you have any more points to add?
Yes, the fact that, you know, teacher is supposed to act like a parent also. You know, there are three kinds of parents we have. Your real parent, as for example, your father, the father in matrimony, and your father is a teacher. So the teacher should act like a father. For example, if the child is suffering something, the teacher should notice that. So the child feels a spirit of being wanted and liked. You know, sometimes the child is so tired and sleepy, the teacher should have compassion on the child and say that today I'm seeing that you're very sleepy. Why don't you go and, you know, like put water in your face. Wash your face and come healthy, or go out and just have a little run. You know, a jog and come back so that you can feel uplifted and better. So the child will feel that he cares about me the way the parent cares, you know. Of course, it can never be the same, but that respect will be formed. And the child will never take advantage of sleeping in front of the teacher or doing naughty, funny things in front of the teacher or even shouting towards the teacher front of the teacher.
So this is very true. I feel like a teacher's job is a bit difficult, but there are so many talented people out there. And I've seen that a lot of children really, really idolize their teachers, showing that those teachers have done a good job. Inshallah, that we, if we're trying to be teachers, we try and be, you know, such teachers. So we're going to stop for a short break, inshallah, and we will continue with the next question after the break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and we have been discussing about some very interesting questions. We had another question over here, and somebody was asking, how can we motivate a teenager? Right now, you know, teens are kind of difficult to control, difficult to, you know, satisfy. They're very, you know, their emotions are very high.
Yeah,
it gets difficult.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that, you know, motivation is something that a factor that... It should be in every level of every human being, even an old person, even a young child, even an adolescent, even a teenager, even a youth. In whatever phase of life a person is, if they don't have motivation, they won't feel like continuing anything that they're doing. They'll feel it's baseless, it's pointless. So this factor of motivation should always be strengthened in a person. Even we right now, we need this motivation to come and, you know, to portray what we are going to speak, to, you know, relate to the people. Without motivation, we wouldn't have interest in what we are speaking, and it would show in our tones. But we want something to happen out there for people to realize that, you know, life is just not something that needs to pass along just like that. There is a purpose to life. So everything you do, there is a motivation behind it. Otherwise, it'll be like pointless to do it, right?
Yeah.
And mainly the best thing is that why we worship God, there should be a motivation behind that. So God forbid there's a day that you feel the same old routine, praying two rakat, then eating, then going to study, then coming back from a school, and then eating again, and the same old things.
Yeah.
A person feels very frustrated at that, yeah? But if he has a motivation, they'll feel, what am I doing this for?
Yeah.
I have a higher purpose. I'm doing it for the sake of Allah. These things will never be wasted.
But I feel at times youth don't really get attracted to such concepts. Like they feel like, okay, yeah, okay, we are doing it for Allah, but like, where is this going to take me? You know, right?
Yeah, exactly. It starts with that. Where is it going to take me?
Okay.
And then it ends with that. That's the highest stage that it's done for Allah. Because even wherever it takes you, it's not enough. You know, we are people of perfection. We want perfection in everything. But when we get that perfection, we realize it wasn't perfect.
Mm.
So we are not happy at that point in time. We want more. And when that more even comes, we feel we realize we want more.
Yeah.
So what is the ultimate? The ultimate is Allah, right?
True.
Allah's love, you know, being attached to Allah and things like that. The good virtues that Allah wants us to, you know, develop. So, of course, it comes with this, that motivation in what you do, anything with a purpose. Do it with a purpose. Do it interestingly. So how does that come about? It's also requires a lot of enthusiasm and the, you know, provocation of thoughts. You need to a lot of think about how to get it, and a lot of responsibility, a lot of persistence, a lot of resilience, and a lot of hard work, of course. But it comes. The outcome is there. Motivation comes. And again, here, we talked about, in our previous episodes, we talked about the process of, the you know, the efforts that you put on, yeah?
Yeah.
So to get a person motivated in whatever they do, make them feel that the process of becoming motivated and disciplined is what is important, not the outcome.
Oh.
Teach the child that the outcome will be sometimes not according to what our wish wants, you know, what we wish. But it's the process that you do. And such a process is something that should be enjoyable.
Yeah. And that process is what's going to make you grow.
Yeah, the process is what's making a difference in your life.
We're just going to take another short break and we'll be continuing soon after.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and we have been discussing about some very interesting questions. Somebody was asking, how can we motivate a teenager?
Okay, we can mention any example focusing on the effort. For example, if it's a football match and your child is losing always, focus on how he plays and how he loves playing,
yeah,
and how he gets that exercise and how he gets that feeling of happiness. When, you know, when you do exercise, the hormones, they are secreted to make a person feel very balanced, very happy also. There are certain hormones secreted that are poisonous and they go,
yeah,
you know, in form of sweat. So what remains is those hormones that keep you calm. Even it's very good to encourage an adolescent to do exercise, because they would have those bad thoughts coming in their mind, you know, thoughts that disturb them. So exercise is something so important, the procedure of doing it. For example, a person wants to lose weight. You can encourage them that whilst you're doing exercise, how good you feel. That's the important thing. So that adds to the motivation. But if you think the end result, it will make you perplexed.
Yeah.
What will you achieve? How many, for example, what will you lose? Or how much weight will you lose? Or will we win the football match or not? What's the use? Or can I cook, for example, will I get that result that I want? Then you'll stop it. But if you keep on enjoying what you're making, that's the beauty in it.
So. And I feel like in the world today, because of social media, the youth are wasting a lot of their time, or they're feeling like they're end result is, you know, what's going to make them maybe more rich or what's going to make them more acknowledged. Sometimes that's kind of limiting their progress in life. And I think that's why they lack so much motivation. Like, it's hard to motivate them because they feel like they're getting temporarily satisfied through the social media, through their phones. And so it gets so difficult to get them out of that, to show them that there is a greater purpose in life.
And the social media puts it in such a way that the result is better than the process of efforts. Yeah.
True.
So the efforts, in a way, it's something that is so beautiful that even the result cannot be that beautiful. For example, if the process of doing something like a business is achieving great wealth, if you don't achieve that, they make it look that the wealth is more beautiful than the process. But the process only of putting your effort and, for example, starting a business or even a simple business of running a shop, just to meet the customers and to exchange this, you know, salams and to sell them and to pass your time in this way that you're talking to people, you're looking at people, you're encouraging the people and, you know, you're passing your time in this way. For example, it's your business that you have to. There are other goals, divine things that you could do. But for example, if a person wants wealth,
yeah,
in the end, what is it? That satisfaction. Or a person, if you're selling food, for example, the satisfaction that you cooked a nice meal.
True.
That's the important thing. Not that money you earn. That is not as attractive as the fact that you made people happy when they ate the food, right?
Very true.
So this is very important about how to motivate a youth. And we'll talk about how to then talk to a youth about what matters so as to add to the motivation, inshallah, in our next episode.
Inshallah. Thank you very much. And we hope to see you in the next episode. Dear audience, thank you very much for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.ir. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves. leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way. It's a complete way.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Allah, 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 Allah.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
This is a short part of Imam Khomeini's speech, Duty of the Theological Schools in Training of Judges. The judiciary must take care that it is concerned with the life and properties of the people. The honor of the people and their job demands. Thus, they must appoint pious people there. They must be upright individuals and be careful not to make a mistake, for the error of the judge can cause great damage and can be tragic if it is deliberate.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. On the subject of women's rights in Islam, Imam Khomeini رحمة الله عليه said, Islam put women on a par with men and made them equal with them. Of course, there are certain Islamic precepts which apply only to men and others which apply only to women. But this does not mean that Islam discriminates between men and women. Here, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is focusing on the equality between men and women in Islam. You know, in Islam, a woman has the basic freedom of choice and expression based on recognition of her individual personality. First, she is free to choose her religion. The Holy Book of Quran states, A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim, Rectitude has become distinct from error. Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 256. There are many traditions of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which indicate women would pose questions directly to him and offer their opinion concerning religion, I don't know, economics and social matters as well. A Muslim woman chooses her husband and keeps her name after marriage. A Muslim woman's testimony is valid in legal disputes. In fact, in areas in which women are more familiar, their evidence is conclusive as well.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi. Oh.
world, the value of humankind in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is defined through humanity, which is emphasized by the Holy Book of Quran too. The status and individuality of human beings, as well as their rights of freedom, have a structure which has been provided by the Islamic teachings and the brilliant commendations of Quran as well. Outside these holy borders, the human status of mankind is manipulated by the carnal desires of dishonest people, and it will not have a genuine definition and content anymore. The Muslim woman was given a role, duties, and rights 1,400 years ago that most women do not enjoy even now and today in the Western countries. These rights are from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and are designed to keep balance in society. You see how beautiful these sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi was. I really do like it. For ending this recite, the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi about women's right in Islam once more. Islam put women on a par with men and made them equal with them. Of course, there are certain Islamic precepts which apply only to men and others which apply only to women. But this does not mean that Islam discriminates between men and women. Thank you very much for listening to us, and until another episode, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Economic divide.
The U.S. Israeli genocidal war is continuing thanks to the U.S. disagreements over the cessation, wanting only a pause. Well, we ask, has Israel taken into consideration the economic costs? The budget surely could not predict the length of the onslaught at a minimum, hence the cost, nor can it now as to when it's going to end. So how much has this onslaught cost Israel? That's the focus of this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the highlights of this program, Israel's economic costs, we're looking at $600 million per week, give or take. That's the problem. They're not sure. You have the reservist salaries, again, a number which is not consistent with their predictions, and how businesses are going to be compensated, all affecting the bottom line there in Israel. Then you have the economic crisis as a result of all of this. Business shutdowns have occurred. There's been a lack of workers in different sectors, such as hospitality, agriculture, and construction. And then the challenges that Israel is facing at this point. There's a capital flight. There's exodus out of Israel, capital flight meaning investments, and also you have the uprising that's taking place in the occupied West Bank. On how many fronts is Israel actually finding itself?
As the U.S.-Israel genocidal war in Gaza enters its third month and the death toll continues to rise, Israel's economy is also paying a heavy price. According to some reports, more than 760,000 Israelis are not working due to the genocidal war. That is 18% of the regime's workforce. Most of these are serving as reservists. Some of them have also been evacuated from their settlements near Gaza and Lebanon. Many businesses in the occupied territories have suspended their operations there. A wide range of industries has been affected. They include entertainment, hospitality, agriculture, high-tech, and textile. The labor shortage in high-tech is especially worrying. since that sector accounts for nearly 20% of Israel's gross domestic product, GDP, and almost half of the regime's exports. The tourism and entertainment industries are also suffering from the effects of the U.S.-Israel genocidal war. A third of restaurants in major cities have not reopened since October 7th. That's due to a lack of employees and sometimes a lack of customers as well. The construction sector has also been affected. That is because of a shortage of labor, which is mainly recruited from Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Time to find out what's being posted online on this special social media post. We're actually going to start out with a website. And this is a flashback in order for you to see what Israel faced before going into this genocidal war. Israel's economy may lose $14 billion annually due to the so-called judicial overhaul crisis that it was experiencing, in which the judicial overhaul planned to trigger mass protests in Israel. That's before, so you can see the challenge that Israel faced. Now, a viewer comment. A Jew who is against occupation is the name of this viewer comment, who said that U.S. taxpayers will pay for all Israeli war efforts and war crimes, as always. Next, another website, War on Gaza. Despite U.S. aid, Israel's economy has been hit hard. And this was written on the 19th of December. So this is what this website then went on to add. Urgent American aid may help partially, but the damage to the Israeli economy as a result of its war on Gaza has been done and will escalate. Furthermore, the military industry, another one of Israel's major export sectors, will also be harmed as all local production is directed to the troops in the battle. And finally, Israel's budget deficit soars in November as government pours 5.8 billion shekels into Gaza war. Figures show the budget deficit is swelling to 3.4% as the government expenditure is has been increased to 46.9 billion shekels and tax revenues drop to 16.5%, led by sharp declines in income from real estate taxes. Well, as you just read there, these are different ways that the Israeli economy is actually impacted and how it's losing money overall. For the first segment of our Q&A, Alice Rothschild joins us. Alice Rothschild is a author and filmmaker. She's author of Broken Promises and Broken Dreams, and she's also a member of the Jewish Voice for Peace. Alice Rothschild, welcome to the program. So the genocidal war has entered its third month. It's a grim milestone, looking at about 20,500 deaths. Israel's economy is paying a price at the same time. A whole range of industries are affected, hospitality, entertainment, agriculture, and the most important one, high tech. Now, I'd like to focus in my question to you on the workforce shortage. How can the lack of workers be solved when Israel is continuing with this genocidal war?
Well, we know that about 18% of the workforce is not working in the usual economy, either because they're reservists fighting this war or they're displaced people from the borders of Israel. And it seems that the only way that the economy will recover is if Israel isn't using these workers to fight the war. So ending the war seems to be the most reasonable alternative. I should point out, though, that when you think about it, the companies that supply the military, that supply the surveillance, that supply all the weapons, they're probably making a lot of money. So there are certain sectors that are obviously making huge profits from war, but the main sector of, you know, technology and entertainment and all the tourism and those kind of sectors are suffering.
All right, thank you for that. Let's bring in the next guest, Wafik Faour. Vermonters for Justice in Palestine. I guess he's a Vermonter, maybe, that he is part of this group. But thank you, Wafik Faour, for joining us here in this program. The Israeli economy is heavily losing money. Different sectors of the economy is a testament to that. We're looking at one figure that's pretty high, $600 million per week, spending millions to pay with the reservists, salaries, and also compensation for businesses that were affected by the war are the added cost. How do you think Israel is going to be able to sustain this momentum, especially since there are really no signs as to when this U.S.-Israeli genocidal war is going to end?
Yeah. 20% of the Israeli workers are part of the reserve army, and they are not functioning. Two, there is another problem that our activism for boycotting Israeli products which is taking more effect after the war against Gaza. And we're finding it that many companies are losing because of that. So Israel economy is not going to be the same economy pre-October 7.
Time now for the InfoNews section of the program. Again, we are focused on the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. First up, a boycott took place by a country by the name of Malaysia, and they are very much into this anti-Israeli and the genocidal war that is executing on the Gaza Strip. Malaysia has actually banned Israeli flagged ships from its ports in response to Gaza war, and that is an unprecedented move against, in this case, the Israeli entity. Prime Minister has said that Israel's actions violate international law through the ongoing massacre and the brutality against Palestinians. This may start a trend. We have to wait and see as long as this genocidal war continues. Next up, the entry read cashing in on genocide. It went on to say Israeli firm pitches beachfront real estate in leveled Gaza. So basically, there's a picture that they posted, and it had villas in the Gaza Strip, and behind it, there were destroyed buildings. This is no joke. It said a house on the beach is not a dream. That's what the ad read, and came from this company, which is notorious for building in the occupied West Bank. Obviously, we had to have our take on this, and we look at such plans that have been compared with the Nakba ethnic cleansing of more than 750,000 Palestinian Arabs by deadly violence and forced displacement by the Israeli regime from Palestine during the establishment of Israel back in 1948. All right. Next up, the port by the name of Eilat of Israel. It has reached a standstill. The income has been impacted. 85% is the announcement that was made. We have now seen for the port to be inactive based on certain reports. This, of course, is because of the fact that you have the entry calls at Houthis, we call it the Ansarullah Movement, or the Yemeni army, really, that have escalated the attacks in the Red Sea. It's at Eilat, which sits adjacent to Jordan's only coastal access point at Aqaba, offers Israel a gateway to the east without the need to navigate the Suez Canal. All right? So that's how serious and successful the Ansarullah Movement and the Yemeni army has been in targeting Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea and beyond even. Now, we focused on the occupied territories where there's a cash crunch, basically, or cash squeeze, where the report said about 50% of early-stage startups have a cash horizon of less than 6 months, based on a survey that was taken. So only up to the next 6 months is the amount of money they have in their reserves. Went on to say more than half of early-stage startups fear that they will not be able to secure another round of critical financing amid this war. Okay, those were the topics we picked for this section. As usual, I should say this would have been something that we may have continued, but at this point, I believe that we're coming out of the genocidal war a little bit. We may focus on another topic for next week, which hence will then lead to the Info News section being a little bit more varied in that respect.
Listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for the in-depth section of the program. We're going to take a look at sectors that have set back the Israeli economy. These are the sectors: company closures, job losses, per capita income, insurance premiums, the tech sector, the big one, and GDP growth, the impact on it. First, we're going to take a look at the company closures in terms of the numbers and how many have closed, 57,000. The reasons for the closures: inflation, 4%, deflation, can't calculate that because it goes into negative territory. Hasn't happened yet. You have the army drafts that are 350 to 400,000, and also the Gaza border evacuations, 700,000. I must say that that's an artificial border that has been placed on the Gaza Strip based on the settlements. Next up, we go to job losses that have occurred. Full-time job losses, 256,000 since the war started. Then you have the temporary workers. They were laid off, 80,000. You have the ones that are now on the assistance by the budget of Israel, 160,000 of them, out of a job. And altogether, 1.3 million in terms of the workforce, that's 30% of it, that are not part of the economy. Next up, we go to per capita income, $54,660 for 2022. Now, this figure has dropped for the year 2023, mainly because of the war now, down to $46,461. That's a 15% decrease. The impacts that this have are many, in which this circle is going to point to it because of the war has affected every Israeli. Standards of living, unemployment, inflation, inequality, all a consequence of this war. So you can see how that is detrimental and how Israel is suffering. Next up, we go to the insurance premiums, non-Israeli vessels, 100%. These are for the shipping, and of course you know that the Yemeni army is targeting the vessels. 250% for Israeli vessels is what the premium has gone up to. Local markets, competitiveness, and imported raw materials all have been affected because of the war, in particular by the Yemeni army targeting Israeli-linked vessels. The all-important tech sector, the investment down 50%. That's a lot. That contributes almost 20% of the Israeli economy. Number of deals down 38%. Again, another big figure. And then you have staff shortages in terms of the employees. They've been called for duty, one of the reasons. But it has reduced the staff by 10 to 15%. Now, the GDP growth, the impact that it has had. Let's look at this before the war, what it was, which is 3.1% for Q1 through 3. And then for Q4, it's down to 2.4%. Okay? So the pivotal and key impact that this has had on Israel and its economy. Well, let's find out what our guests think that's more important about all of this. Let me bring them back. We have Wafik Faor, Vermonters for Justice in Palestine, who rejoins us. Wafik, welcome back to Economic Divide. You know, the war cost is pretty incredible in terms of the numbers, anywhere from $250 to $260 million daily for Israel. On the other hand, of course, the economy is losing money as a result. You have capital flight to add to that. You have mass exodus of people out of Israel. And given Israel's uncertainty when it comes to its economic standing, how can Israel ever regain or try to recoup the losses and even stay afloat based on some accounts?
There is we have to rethink what Israel now, post October 7th. We cannot rethink it that it will regain what they lose on this war. The war in Gaza, it changed all this calculus. Number one, there is opposite or reverse migration from Israel. We heard at least over a quarter of a million of Israeli who carry second passports, they already left Israel. We know that the cheap migrants that they are coming from Thailand, India, and others are leaving Israel. And their farms has no workers and no laborers to continue. Their factories are out of work, and their hotels are closed, no tourism, etc. I don't believe it will repair itself on a short term or long term.
All right. We heard about, obviously, the staff and the number of employees to be the focus of the comments made there by our guest. But there's a more important issue that needs to be dealt with here. I want to ask that from our guest who rejoins us, Alice Rothschild, author and filmmaker. Alice Rothschild, welcome back to the program. I think it's a proper time to address what needs to be addressed. I think it's something that's somewhat maybe forgotten in between the awful and shocking scenes that are coming out of the Gaza Strip, and that is how to deal with this and the root cause of it to be tackled. What do you think? Is that being discussed enough, and how should that be addressed?
Right. So the root causes of this crisis are the ongoing occupation of the occupied territories and the siege of Gaza. It is not a reasonable expectation by Israel and the Israeli government and military to think that you can suppress and oppress a group of people endlessly, and that that somehow keeps Israeli citizens safe. Ultimately, oppressed people will react and try to fight back their oppressive situation. So unless that oppression, the siege, the occupation, the second-class citizenship of Palestinians,